Welcome to the Logic Consortium. Today we're going to be talking with Gary Becker, economist and Nobel Prize winner, about markets for illegal goods. He's going to be talking to us about how important it is to think about elasticity of the demand, meaning how much is the demand going to change even if the good is illegal, and why this concept is important when talking about illegalization of goods such as drugs.
So the more inelastic, in this case, is the demand, the more severe is the punishment, so we have greater increases in price, the greater the increase in the size of this industry.
So I'm on the line with El Chava, my very good friend from Mexico City, and we're going to be talking with Professor Becker about this and some related economic issues. Thanks so much for listening. Please stick around. Hey, Professor, thanks so much for joining. My very good friend's on the line from Mexico City.
Good, bueno. And
hi, Professor Becker. Thanks for taking our call.
That's no problem.
Can you start off by explaining kind of the concept of elasticity to our listeners, and then and then talking about why it's so key to understanding the predicament we're in with the war on drugs?
Well, what elasticity means, if we look at, say, elasticity of demand, it tells you if you lower price, how big is the increase in quantity that people want to consume. So let's say you have a 10% reduction in price. Does quantity grow by 1%? So in that case, a 10% reduction in price, a 1% growth in quantity, we say the elasticity is 1 over 10, or 1/10. On the other hand, if you had a 10% increase in quantity when price fell by 10%, then we would say the elasticity is 1 or minus 1, and so on. So the bigger the response of quantity to any given change in price, the more elastic is demand. And a similar concept would apply to supply. How much does the quantity produced increase when one raises a lower price? The bigger the response of quantity to any given change in price, we would say you then have a more elastic supply curve. Okay? So that's why that's the definition.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium and our conversation with economist Gary Becker. He was just explaining to us the basics of elasticity of supply and demand, just really saying that the supply or the demand of a certain good is inelastic when neither the supply or the demand change very much when the good is illegal. So there's still a ton of supply and there's still a ton of demand even though it's illegal. That would make it inelastic. So now he's going to explain to us why it's important. Please stick around. Thanks so much.
So now, why are they important? They're important for the following reason, that if you, say, make drugs illegal and you punish people who engage in the drug business, by punishing them, you raise the cost to them of being in the business, because they not only have to look at the cost of production, but also they have to look at, you know, what type of punishment would they get if they're caught. They may be sent to prison, which is now common in the United States if you a pusher of drugs. So that will increase the price. And when the price increases, then we would ask, what is the effect on the quantity consumed? That we would determine from the elasticity. When the price goes up, let's say, by 50% because it's become illegal, this quantity declined by 10%, 5%, 50%. That would be determined by the elasticity. And number two, and even more important for some purposes, if when price goes up, the quantity goes down by a really small percentage, then the total amount spent on drugs and received by the drug suppliers would go up. So let's say price goes up by 50% and quantity is unchanged, then total spending would be 50% higher. If quantity goes down by 10%, total spending would be 40% higher, and so on. If quantity goes down by 50%, then total spending would be unchanged. And the reason that's important is that total spending measures how much resources are going into this industry. So the more inelastic, in this case, is the demand, the more severe is the punishment, so we have greater increases in price, the greater the increase in the size of this industry. And if you try to look at how much is spent on drugs in the United States, and we've made estimates for the for other countries and even for the world, you find this has become a very big industry. in terms of total spending in this industry, comparable to alcohol and cigarettes, even though the consumption, let's say, of drug is much less than the consumption of alcohol, and is even less than the use of cigarettes on a worldwide basis. It's because of relatively inelastic demand and high effect on price due to the costs imposed on suppliers through, you know, punishments and the like. I hope that, I mean, you know, these are technical concepts, but I hope this gives your listeners some kind of rough view of why elasticities matter and how it matters.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium and our conversation with economist Gary Becker. He was just talking about that when demand of a good is relatively inelastic and a country spends a lot of money or more money on the enforcement and punishment of the good, but isn't really changing the demand, all that is really happening is that the total spending on this industry is going up. So now he's going to talk to us why maybe an excise tax rather than enforcement might be a better way to take with something that has an inelastic demand like drugs or seemingly inelastic. Please stick around. Thanks so much.
Yeah, and can you talk about how this helps us understand why excise taxes, taxing the good, might be better for social welfare than the goods prohibition?
All right. Well, you're raising a good question because we have two ways of trying to affect consumption of drugs, at least two. One is we make it illegal. We punish people, and that raises the cost to producers, so they need a higher price in order to stay in the industry, and that raises price. Another way is to say, well, we're going to legalize it, but we'll put a big tax on it the way we tax cigarettes. You know, cigarettes now have well over 100% tax. We more than double the price of cigarettes. And in some cities like New York City, we probably have trebled the price of cigarettes because of taxes. Alcohol has a pretty significant tax. So a lot of goods, particularly alcohol and cigarettes, have big taxes on them. And what happens when you tax it in this way, you cut down consumption, because when you put a tax on a good, that raises the cost to consumers, because consumers have to pay not only for the cost of the production of the good, like cigarettes, but also they have to pay for the tax of the cigarettes. It's passed on from the producer to the consumer. So that raises the cost to consumers. And that's one justification for taxing, is by raising the cost to the consumer, you cut down consumption of it. But the second important issue is that when you put a tax on, whatever increase in price and reduction in consumption, that difference goes as tax revenue to the taxing authority, whether it's the city or the state or the federal government who is imposing the taxes. So it's paid for by the consumer, is received by as revenue by the government. The government then maybe can cut other taxes because they're getting revenue from this tax. On the other hand, when you make it illegal and you raise price by punishment, it not only isn't the government getting any revenue from that, but it's adding to its cost, not subtracting, because it has to pay for the prisons and the cost of incarcerating the people who are put into prison on drug charges. And that's an important part of the U.S. Prison population now. And you have to realize it takes $30,000 to $40,000 per year to house a prisoner in the United States. That's almost equal to the average income of the typical working person, full-time working person. So it's very expensive to house them. So when you make a good illegal, you don't get the revenue because the tax is in the form of punishments and the like, restrictions on output. There's no revenue coming to the government from this because there's no tax revenue. And in fact, there's a cost coming to the government. You have police that are chasing down criminals. You have the court system that is trying them. And then you have the prison system that is housing them. And all those three things add up to significant costs. Very different from when you have a monetary tax. Put a tax on, producers pay the tax, and that what they pay goes to the government, hopefully, who then can cut other taxes. So you make people, the taxpayer, better off as a result of that.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium and our conversation with economist Gary Becker. He was just talking about how the enforcement of drugs, enforcement and punishment of drugs, is really such an enormous expenditure for the government. and it really doesn't seem to be lowering the consumption, the amount of drugs that people are consuming. And that a monetary tax might be a better route because it could generate revenue instead of all the sunken costs into investigation, prosecution, and the like. Now my co-host Suhava is going to ask the professor about the potential effects of legalizing drugs and whether or not consumption might increase. So please stick around. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Professor Becker, let me make you a question. So the argument seems to rely on the demand for drugs being inelastic. So say you legalize it and there's like new entry of consumers. Some people that before didn't want to try, but now that it's legal, then they enter and they want to consume the good. Wouldn't that may make the demand more elastic than maybe not making your point that strong anymore?
Yeah, yes, it would. But on the other hand, you have to think of two other factors. One, some people, particularly, you know, drug consumption is begun usually at teenage, when people are teenagers. If you haven't used drugs and by the time you're 30, it's very unlikely you're going to use a drug. That's just a fact. It's also true about smoking. It's also true about some other characteristics. And some teenagers will stop taking a drug precisely because it is legal. One of the attractions to them being of a drug is that they're going against authority. You know, they're consuming something that their adult population looks down upon and has made illegal. So there are some people who would stop taking it. Other people will come into the market. Now, the question of how elastic is the demand for drugs, that's not crucial to my argument. You can have it even more elastic, and the same principles go through, although they'll be weakened to some extent. But this is an empirical question, and people have estimated. There are estimates in the literature of the how responsive are consumers to changes in price. And the data I have seen on this, and that's done in a number of ways. In some countries, at some periods of time, drugs were legal, so you can estimate the elasticity under those circumstances. At other times, what is done in the United States is that policemen and federal agents, they go out, they get evidence on the prices, the street prices of drugs by posing as buyers, and they're not out to arrest anyone. They're just trying to collect prices, actually, these agents. They collect prices, so we know something about drug prices, and we know something from other surveys on how much people say they use of drugs. So you can link those two things up to try to estimate in areas where prices are higher or time periods when prices are higher, what happens to consumption. And those estimates also suggest that demand is relatively inelastic.
And sometimes people argue against taxation because they say that people will try to avoid the tax and they'll have clandestine businesses. But you don't see that as a problem, do you?
Not a major problem. I'll explain to you why. You know, they can do that for cigarettes, too. They can do that for alcohol. And there is some underground, you know, use of cigarettes. That cigarettes go from low tax states to high tax states. We've estimated the magnitude of that. It's not trivial, but it's not the dominant part. They don't do that for gasoline, which has a pretty high tax in many countries, not so much in the United States, but in other countries. They don't do that for alcohol. Most of it is produced above ground, and I'll explain to you why. Under the present system, there would be a lot of people who might want to go into legal, into the production of drugs. They don't want to be criminals, right? So the only people you can attract to the drug market now on the production side are people who are willing to become criminals and run the risk, you know, of being sentenced to jail and having spending prison time and other, you know, negative attributes of being that. When you legalize it and tax it, then, yes, it's true, some people can be criminals. That is, they'll produce it by avoiding the tax underground. But you now provide an option. You provide the legal option that isn't available to people under the president. I can legally produce drugs, and there are great advantages in producing something legally. You can sign contracts. You can enforce contracts without threatening to shoot somebody, you know, or break somebody's kneecaps. I mean, there are lots of advantages to producing above ground and a below ground. So when we legalize alcohol after the end of Prohibition in the United States in the early 1930s, what you found was that during the Prohibition period, you had a lot of gangsters, mainly gangsters who are in the industry. Al Capone is very famous from Chicago as a bootlegger. But you have many other gangsters. When you legalized it and taxed it, the role of gangsters in the production of alcohol was dropped down to a really small effect. And then you got Seagram's and a lot of perfectly legitimate companies who could produce this good better than the gangsters could. They were good at production. They had organized methods. They had economies of scale. They did it upright. They had contracts with suppliers and so on. They were just much more efficient. And that's what you would get if you legalized. Yes, there would be some underground. We'd have to concentrate on trying, you know, to discourage that. But we, instead of having to discourage all the production, we'd have to be discouraging, I think, a pretty small fraction of the total production. So it would be a much easier problem to take care of.
I wanted to ask you about the politics of all this. As you mentioned, every president since Nixon has been fighting a so-called war on the production of drugs with no success whatsoever. Things might be even bad now as they've ever been. In terms of the policy debate, decriminalization and legalization are now being proposed by not just libertarians, with this big Latin American Commission on Drugs and Democracy last year, which gained a lot of fanfare. No, I guess my question is, do you think that it might be possible from a policy standpoint to talk about this, at least in the U.S., and what might be the impetus, if not the terrible violence and problems that we're seeing?
Yeah. Well, you know, when you want to get a radical shift in policy, it takes time, and I think it eventually will happen. I am confident about that. Just like, you know, it took a long time to get a voluntary army, but we did it, and people active in it did it, but it took a while. I think it'll take a while. Most politicians, you know, they definitely would say they're opposed to decriminalization and legalization, at least on any large scale. Maybe some of them will be persuaded, you know, about marijuana. Now, New Jersey passed legalizing marijuana for medical uses. So, you know, sometimes these things come in increments. They come slowly. But I do think, relative to the time I first started thinking about drugs, which was a couple of decades ago at least, there's been some movement. Some leaders of the African-American community have come out and said, look, these drugs are killing our communities. We should think about decriminalizing at least some of the drugs. And you didn't hear that 20 years ago. Legalizing it for medical purposes. Again, you didn't even hear that much 20 years ago. So I think we're getting movement. You know, it takes time. It takes greater realization about the costliness of this system in terms of what it's doing to neighborhoods and communities. And what it's done to Mexico, because the drug cartels there are mainly exporting drugs into the United States, what it's done to Colombia, and so on. So what it's doing to Afghanistan. And so I think I'm optimistic, but I've learned from experience with a lot of different policies that things just don't change around overnight. But I think there is movement. It's slow, but there is movement. And I think in the next decade we'll see further movement. When we'll get substantial movement, I'm not sure yet. But I think we are seeing movement. I think because of the realization, you know, how difficult this is. We can't stamp out drugs. What it does is it puts drugs in the hands of cartels, often very vicious cartels, who don't hesitate to shoot down policemen and political leaders and journalists and the like, as is happening in Mexico and other parts of Latin America, and it happens in the United States, particularly with regard to policemen and innocent bystanders. So I think we're seeing some movement, but you know, if one believes that this is an important change, one has to keep pushing and trying to persuade and showing the cost of the system. And I think ultimately democracies respond to that, although it takes time.
Hello, you're listening to The Logic Consortium in our conversation with economist Gary Becker. He was just talking about his article, The Market for Illegal Goods, and really giving us some insight into the unsuccessful war on drugs in the United States. Now, El Chava is going to ask the professor about an emerging field of economics, which studies the happiness of people, and whether people report they are happier when they live in richer countries, or whether they report being happier when they're richer than the average person in their own country.
So please stick around. Thanks so much for listening.
Professor Becker, I was recently visiting your blog, and I saw some post about, relative to the Easterling paradox and how happiness really hasn't increased over time that much. Would you like to comment on how much do you think this may be due to, say, the income inequality? I mean, this sort of effect of relative consumption valuation rather than absolute, which we as economists may be missing. Do you think that those two concepts may be related?
Well, for the listeners, let me try to give them a little background. There are surveys taken of how happy people are within the United States and now many countries, actually. But initially, there were only a few countries in it, mainly richer countries. And what these surveys found at that time, which what created the paradox, was that if you looked at within a country, on the average, higher-income people reported themselves as happier than lower-income people. And that result has continued to be found in virtually every country, if not every country, that's been studied and over time and so on. Higher income people within a country report themselves as happier. There's no paradox about that. You have more income, economists would say, you can do more things, and that's why people want to get more income. On the other hand, the paradox was the initial studies tended to find that richer countries, on the average, were no happier than poorer countries. That was the claim. So the question was, well, if higher income people within a country are happier, why aren't, on the average, people in richer countries happier than people in poorer countries? And so the hypothesis was suggested that one's happiness depends upon one's relative position in the income distribution, say, within a country. So if you're richer relative compared to others, you're happier. When everybody's income grows over time, because as the average income of a country rises, then the relative position, there are people still in particular relative positions. Somebody's at the top 10%, the second 10%, the third 10%, and so on. And therefore, this theory would say you shouldn't find people any happier. Well, unfortunately for the theory, as new evidence developed for many more countries, and now we have evidence for maybe 100 countries or so, and for very relatively poor countries or quite poor countries like in Africa and in middle-level countries and in rich countries, you do find that richer countries on the average are reporting significantly more happiness than very poor countries. So what appeared to be a paradox has disappeared once we had more data. The paradox was a result of the fact that the initial studies only looked at a few quite rich countries. And so between these countries, the United States compared to Denmark, maybe the U.S. wasn't any happier than Denmark. But the differences in income by world standards between the United States and Denmark on a per capita basis are pretty small. It's if you compare the United States to Mexico, or the United States, even more extreme, to Liberia or Nigeria, where you find extreme differences in income. And you do find very big differences in average degree of happiness. So I think that Easterling paradox has disappeared. Now, there is another statistic that's a bit troubling, that if you look at within a country, as incomes grow within a country, you'd think people would report themselves as happier. And that is found for most countries. On the other hand, it doesn't seem to be true for the United States in surveys about happiness that have been taken since 1980, or so the last 30 years. And so people have tried to study why, and one of the explanations has been sort of related to income inequality, but in a different way, that we've had a significant growth in income inequality in the United States since 1980, and the way you combine to get an average degree of happiness is a function of what the distribution of income is. That's a little bit of a technical point, but it does say that when income becomes more unequal and more skewed, it may be that some measures of average happiness won't change, even if in some other measures happiness has increased. That's one suggestion that's been put forward. It seems to explain some of the reasons why happiness hasn't increased. But it is still a bit of a puzzle why, while in many countries happiness has grown when incomes have grown, this hasn't been as obvious in the United States. I don't have a good answer for that. But overall, you find income and happiness are positively correlated.
You're listening to The Logic Consortium and our conversation with economist Gary Becker. He was just talking about the happiness literature and the correlation between income and happiness. And now he's going to be asked about the stimulus package, the big Obama stimulus package. So please stick around. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Professor Becker. The last question that I would like to make is regarding the fiscal stimulus that the U.S. is has been put over the last year. And to judge for the last data of unemployment, do you feel that this may be a signal that the fiscal stimulus hasn't been enough, or that is maybe time to switch a strategy? Maybe I don't know what your reading of this situation is.
I was never a supporter of the so-called fiscal stimulus. It was badly designed from the point of view of improving job creation. It was more a chance to re-engineer where government was spending. So we had a lot spent on health and education, energy sectors, where there isn't a lot of unemployment to soak up. So any effects on unemployment are going to have to be very indirect and not direct. Not so much has gone into construction, where we do have a lot of unemployment, or some other activity. So it's badly designed. Really, I think it was only partially designed to be a stimulus and partially designed to really change the priorities of where we're spending money. So I'm not surprised that it isn't so obvious that this has had very major positive effects on unemployment or the economy in general. I don't think it has had. I think, no, we don't want a bigger stimulus. We don't want to have another stimulus. Because I think the economy will recover, and we don't want to have further spending that increases the budgetary deficits. I think you'll see a bigger increase in GDP growth in the fourth quarter of 2010. Unemployment, I think companies are hesitating about because there's so much uncertainty created by so many proposals that have been put before Congress. The companies are a little hesitant to hire more workers now, and they're not quite sure what public policy, among other things, what public policies will be available. The financial sector is still in considerable difficulties. So I think unemployment's going to lag, and maybe income growth isn't going to be as strong as it might have been. I think the stimulus is as likely to make matters worse as to make it better.
Thanks a lot for your
Thank you so much for your time. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello, everyone. You're listening to the Logic Consortium, and that was our interview with Gary Becker. Our main focus of the interview was, of course, his article on illegal goods, called The Market for Illegal Goods. And his main conclusion was that when you have a good whose supply and demand is relatively inelastic, and you increase the punishment for the consumption or the distribution of this good, all you're really doing is increasing the total amount of resources spent on this industry, which is harmful to the social welfare. So thanks for listening, and thanks to Scientific Map for this music. You can visit our blog by searching Logic Consortium, and you can find past shows, you can make comments. So thanks so much, and take care. Have a great day.